This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Terry McMillan's new novel was published this week, and it went immediately to number 6 on the New York Times bestseller list. Waiting to Exhale tells the story of four women whose friendships support them through their troubled relationships with men. They are, as McMillan puts it, waiting to exhale, waiting for that man who will take their breath away. In a review of the book in the New York Times, Susan Isaacs noted the novel is about more than four lives. The bonds among the women are so alive and so appealing, they almost seem a character in their own right. Waiting to Exhale is McMillan's third novel. It follows Mama and Disappearing Acts. 2 years ago, she edited an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction called Breaking Ice. Before we talk, McMillan will read from the opening of Waiting to Exhale.
Right now, I'm supposed to be all geeked up because I'm getting ready for a New Year's Eve party that some guy named Lionel invited me to. Sheila, my baby sister, insisted on giving me his phone number because he lives here in Denver, and her simpleton husband played basketball with him 11 years ago at the University of Washington. And since I'm still single, which is downright pitiful to her, considering I'm the oldest of four kids and the only one who has yet to say I do, she's worried about me. She and Mama both think I'm out here dying of loneliness, which is not true. I mean, I have my days and I have my nights, but I haven't gotten to the point where I'll take whatever I can get. There's a big difference between being thirsty and being dehydrated. But Sheila and Mama have always thought that something was better than nothing, and look where it's gotten them. Mama, who thinks she's an expert on everything, hasn't had a whole man in her life for 17 years. And if I knew where my daddy was, I'd probably kill him for making her such a bitter woman. He broke her heart, and she's never recovered. And Sheila? She files for divorce on an annual basis and calls me collect from some cheap motel where she and the kids are hiding out until she can serve the papers on Paw. I listen to her whine for hours about how sick she is of him and that there's nothing he can do or say that would make her go back this time. But then, like a fool, she turns right around and calls him up, repeats her long list of needs that aren't being met, and he promises to give her anything she wants. She refuses to believe him, so he begs on a daily basis for 2 weeks, and by then he's convinced her that he means it, so she gives in and goes on back home. I rarely hear from her while they're honeymooning, except maybe a 3-minute synopsis of how hunky-dory everything is now, and because he's given her permission to go ahead and rip out the old carpet or buy some new dining room furniture, she's watching her money, which is why she can't talk long. One of my brothers is in prison for doing something stupid, passing counterfeit money, but he's not a criminal. And the other one's a lifer in the Marine Corps, so as far as taking advice from any of them goes, I'm skeptical. The deal is the men are dead in Denver, which is only one reason why I'm leaving. I'm tired of this altitude, all this damn snow, and this obsession with the Denver Broncos. For the last 3 years, my life has felt inconsequential, like nobody really gives a damn what I'm doing or how well I do it. From the outside, everything looks good. I've got a decent job, money in the bank, live in a nice condo, and drive a respectable car. I've got everything I need except a man. And I'm not one of these women who thinks that a man is the answer to everything, but I'm tired of being by myself. Being single isn't half as much fun as it used to be.
Terry McMillan, when was being single fun?
When I was in my 20s. Before I had my son. Before I became a mother.
Because
I didn't care. I wasn't so interested in getting married at the time. I was having a ball.
Uh-huh. And then you became a mother, a single mother, soon after becoming a mother. And I guess that changed things?
Well, I think once I was in my early 30s, it wasn't just being a mother, to be honest with you. It was being in my 30s. And then I looked up one day, and I was 35. And then I was 36, and then 37, and then 38. And then I said, wait a minute. Something is wrong with this picture. So, it's not like I'm miserable. I'm not miserable. But I would prefer that it not be this way. But like Savannah, I'm not ready to take whatever I can get. Because if that's the case, I would have been divorced 5 times by now. Because I have been proposed to. But then I looked at him and said, I don't think so. Not the rest of my life.
Does each of the four women in your new novel represent one of your friends or a certain type of woman?
I think more type. No, after having been threatened by a lawsuit for disappearing acts, I made sure. I mean, I even cleared some of these chapters with some of my friends to make sure that they did not feel as if they were being portrayed. But fortunately, women are a lot smarter than men. And a lot of my friends said, don't even worry about it, Terry. I've been in that situation before, and in some instances I was aware of it and some I wasn't. So they just told me, look, you know, a lot of this stuff we all can identify with, so I'm not taking this personally, because I didn't lift my friends' experiences and put them in the book. I made a point of not doing that this time around.
I want to get back to the lawsuit that you mentioned. And this stems back to the father of your child sued you after your previous novel, Disappearing Acts, because mm-hmm. he felt that the main character, the male main character in the novel was based on him, and he sued for libel.
Mm-hmm.
The case was was dismissed from the New York Supreme Court.
And the Court of Appeals.
Mm-hmm. What effect did this lawsuit have on you, you know, if somebody suing you for libel over a book of fiction?
Well, first of all, I mean, it really hurt me, to be honest with you, because I hadn't libeled him or defamed him. And if I had really told the truth, I mean, really told the truth, then I could see him being upset. But that's not what I did. I created a work of fiction. And so for him to come after me this way, basically, I mean, he did it for the attention. He did it basically to humiliate me. But I knew in my heart that I did not write this book with malice and that I had not portrayed him personally. And the character that I created and portrayed was accurate because I made him up.
I wonder how concerned your publisher was over this lawsuit, because it would have had, I think, a pretty chilling effect on other novelists.
Well, my publisher was very supportive because they knew, too. I mean, I told the truth in a fictional sense. And, I mean, Viking is really good, and this isn't the first lawsuit that they've had, and it's not the first lawsuit that's been brought against an author. It just so happened that this one got a lot of attention, and part of the reason it got the attention it got was because of his sleazebag lawyer, who made sure he went straight to the New York Post, you know, and then other people caught on. And, I mean, it was newsworthy, and, I mean, that's what the media does. They look for dirt, and they play on it, and that's what happened. So he had his 15 minutes of fame. So, you know, I mean, he embarrassed me more than anything, because I was more concerned that my readers would assume that I didn't have an imagination and that I hadn't, in fact, made this story up. And that was the part, I think, more than anything that I really resented, because it was fiction.
It sounds like this lawsuit, although it was dismissed, still had a chilling effect on you, because you said before you were almost afraid to really write about people that you knew after this experience?
Well, not so much afraid, but what happened was, I mean, I had to go through a phase where I realized that I was not going to let him paralyze me. And, I mean, I had to go through that first before I was able to just sit down and tell my story. Because a lot of times when you're telling a story, you don't know to some degree. You don't sit there, and there's not this real clear line of demarcation where you realize what's real and what's not real, what you've seen and not seen, what you've experienced, what your friends have experienced, what you've read in a paper, a magazine, what you remember 5 years ago. You don't know, and that's why it's fiction.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. My guest is novelist Terry McMillan. Her new novel is called Waiting to Exhale. We're after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Novelist Terry McMillan is my guest. I'd like to get your reaction to something that David Nicholson wrote in a review of your previous book in the Washington Post. He wrote, "McMillan may have created a whole new category, the post-feminist black urban romance novel." What do you think of that?
Well, I don't like to think of my books as romance novels, first of all, but I sort of know what he meant. I think it was meant to be flattering, but I don't like to think of myself as being up there with Danielle Steele and Judith Krantz and the like. I think what he was inferring, at least the way I took it, was that you don't often see romance in novels by black authors. And I deal with sexuality, sensuality, a certain amount of eroticism. And you get to see black men and black women showing and demonstrating a certain amount of passion towards each other, where in a lot of our work it's absent. Not all of our work, because there are other people that do it, but it prevails in my work, because I'm just interested in intimacy, to be honest with you.
Let me ask you about the type of criticism that I think this book might end up getting. One, the criticism that these women are too obsessed with men.
It's bullshit. Excuse me. That's a crock of doo-doo. They are not too obsessed with men. The bottom line is that if they were lesbians, they may be more obsessed with women, but it just so happens they're heterosexuals. And I don't think there's anything embarrassing about wanting a companion and wanting to be loved and wanting to love someone. There's nothing embarrassing about that. And, you know, there are too many of us out here right now walking around, parading around. We're living alone. And we're getting by and acting as if it's everything is just okay. But if you had it the way you wanted it, you would not be alone. And I don't see them as being obsessed because they have other things going on in their lives that they are as concerned about. Their children, their parents, their jobs, you know, their own lives, their bodies, everything. It's not just men, but men fit into the whole picture as well. And I don't see anything wrong with that.
Another criticism I can imagine you getting is that you've made black men look bad.
Are you saying that?
No, I'm saying it's a criticism I can imagine you getting. I'm not criticizing you for it. I'm not saying you did that, but I'm saying, look, on the back of your book, there's a quote from Spike Lee, who's kind of predicting that you're going to get this criticism. I'll read the quote.
You don't have to read it.
No, I'll read it. I've got it right here. He says, "No doubt when this book is published, the author will hear once again, as Zaki Shange did for Colored Girls, Alice Walker for The Color Purple, and Gloria Naylor for The Women of Brewster Place, the cries that the black man has been wronged, the black man has been dogged. I disagree. Terry McMillan has crafted a well-written, truthful, and funny story of four African-American women, four sisters who are trying to make it in this world we all live in, and the sometimes volatile world of black female, black male relationships." Signed, Spike Lee.
Mm-hmm.
So obviously you're anticipating this kind of criticism, or your publisher is.
Well, you know, no, I don't think my publisher was. Basically, so far, I'm really kind of surprised. I mean, I've done about maybe 5 readings now, and the brothers are sort of coming up with, they wait to the end. Until after everybody has asked their questions and made their little comments and stuff, and then they sort of almost eke out, do you think you're going to get criticized? I mean, they haven't, like, jumped on me yet.
What's the origin of that Spike Lee quote? Did the publisher ask
Spike,
him for a
quote? No, Spike read the book, and he said, Terry, you know they're going to jump all over you. And I said, yeah, Spike, I know, but I told a story I wanted to tell, and I'm prepared for it because I'm not going to let the African-American community dictate how I tell a story. And also, when I tell a story, I wish they would just get it once and for all that we, not just myself, but other African-American writers, you know, we're not trying to represent the entire black race. We are telling a story about the characters that inhabit the pages of our book. That's it. You know, and the ones who usually are whining and complaining are the ones who are usually guilty. So I'm not falling for it. I'm just not falling for it. And they can't tell me what to write. And if they don't like it, don't read it. You know, it's some good brothers out here. And the brothers out here who are cool know who they are.
Do you think that there's a different set of problems in black couple relationships than in white couple relationships?
Well, yes and no. I think that all of us have baggage that we bring to a relationship, especially the older we get. I think that black men bring a different kind of baggage. They may bring similar baggage that white men have, but in addition to that, sometimes it's the racial thing. Some of the things that black men have been through, a lot of white men have never experienced. But then again, if we talk about humiliation, there's no color on that. If we talk about helplessness, there's no color on that. But with black men, if the cause of that helplessness is a result of racism, then that's different. Then it's different. But for the most part, a lot of women in general are just sick of being disappointed, sick of men who are afraid of making a commitment, men who are afraid of intimacy, men who lie, men who don't keep their promises. And in that sense, there's no color separation here. You know, I don't know what it's going to take for them to understand that they're missing out on a lot of stuff by being such wusses and being so scared of everything. I mean, there are a lot of really wonderful women and beautiful and smart, intelligent women out here that they seem to be so threatened by and so intimidated by. And, you know, just because we are career women doesn't mean that we still don't want them or love them or care about them or want to share our lives with them. And, you know, it's as if men think that if they fall in love and it doesn't work, that they're going to die, you know?
When you were growing up, did the couples around you, the parents, or, you know, your friends' parents, the aunts and uncles, your parents, the other parents in the neighborhood, did they seem to have good relationships?
A lot of them did. I mean, there were some, I mean, where I grew up, people used to fight. I mean, literally hit each other. In my house, they did. My mother used to hit my father with frying pans, and he'd hit her and punch her lights out and stuff. I mean, violence was, it was almost everywhere. But then again, there were other family members who were more civilized. So I got to see both sides of the coin, and I choose to identify with the kind that was gentle and tender. I saw both, which is why I think I felt this dichotomy. Like, I didn't understand why men and women had to hit each other to make a point. You know, is this the only way you can vent your anger out on each other? And oftentimes, you know, the other person wasn't even the cause of the anger. It was some other stuff. And that's the part that used to baffle me, which is why one time I tried to kill my father for hitting my mother, because I knew she hadn't done anything wrong. I don't think we get that as much. I mean, there are still young men out here who think that the only way they can exercise their masculinity is by hitting their wives or their girlfriends. And they don't understand what it does to children when the children have to see this.
What did you do that time when you almost killed your father, when you tried to
kill him? Well, not so much kill him. What I did was, I didn't know where I got the strength from. I literally just picked him up. And I think I was about 9 or 10. I literally ran between him, he and my mother, and I just picked him up by his shirt and threw him up against the wall. I've done it twice. I mean, I stopped a man from stabbing my mother once. I took the knife out of his hand and put it up to his throat, and told him if he ever in his life ever thought about hurting my mother again. And I swear to God, I was getting ready to kill him. And I was 13, and I will never forget it. And he thought I was crazy, and I was. But not so much that I did it. But I had that knife puncturing his skin, and I swear to God, I'd have killed him. I just told him, you put your hands on my mother again, you're dead.
Who was he?
I don't want to say.
Okay.
I mean, it doesn't matter who he was. He wasn't my father.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, alcohol and drugs are usually what precipitates a lot of this action. You rarely see a man sober hitting his wife unless he's really nuts. Usually it's alcohol or some controlled substance that causes them to go off. That's what I found to be true.
Your previous book before your new novel was an anthology of contemporary African-American fiction that you edited. Can you tell me why you wanted to do the book, what the inspiration was?
I mean, basically, I say it in the introduction that I was basically, and am still basically, fed up and tired of seeing all these anthologies that are published on an annual basis, you know, from Best American Short Stories to the O. Henry Awards, Editor's Choice, Pushcart. And there was no, I went back over 10 years up to like 1980 or 79, I went back. I could count on one hand, or 3-4 fingers, to be honest with you, the number of African-American writers in these anthologies. And it really just made me sick. And I know I knew at the time of a lot of black writers who wrote short stories. And it really just angered me. And I mean, and just the other day, to be honest with you, right before I came to New York, I was at a bookstore in San Francisco. And there it was, Best American Short Stories, O. Henry Awards. So I wait until I get home and I open them up. Sure enough, same thing. 1992, they're doing the same thing. Every story in there is just about, if it's not from The Atlantic, it's from The New Yorker. The New Yorker doesn't publish black writers, let's face it. Jamaica Kincaid, maybe once in a while, I guess, John Wideman. You know, it's sickening. You know, it's sickening. Every year, it's the same people. And I mean, these are good writers. I'm not taking anything away from Joyce Carol Oates, Cynthia Ozick, same writers every single year. They might may as well not even have a contest, if that's what it is. They should just ask Cynthia to send them a story. And Joyce Carol Oates, send them a story. I mean, and they are good writers, don't get me wrong. But a lot of the anthologies that are smaller anthologies that are published by African Americans, they aren't even in the running. They aren't even in the running. And it's sick. It makes me sick. You'd swear we didn't write short stories.
When you're in the middle of writing a book, is it easy for you to keep up with fiction? And especially, I know you're especially interested in keeping up with African American.
You mean
fiction.
Reading?
Yeah, reading.
Well, no. It's hard for me to read writers. And I don't just read African American writers. I read Cynthia Ozick, Joyce Carol Oates, Ann Tyler. I read a lot of people. I try not to limit my I want my world to be as large as possible, and that includes people of all ethnic groups, not just black people, because other people's lives and their backgrounds are just as valid as mine. But when I'm writing, I find it difficult to read writers who I really, really like. I mean, like, I love Kay Gibbons, Walker Percy, Toni Morrison, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. You know, I can't read Zora Neale Hurston or Anne Petrie while I'm writing because I am too influenced. And plus my mind gets, I get wrapped up into their stories and I start forgetting about mine. So I wait. I mean, now I'm on a tour. I have basically 6 weeks. And I'm loaded down with books in my book bag of other people's work. And I'm very excited about the about having the whole summer just to read other people's work.
Terry McMillan, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Terry McMillan's new novel is Waiting to Exhale. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.